Chapter 94. Quarrel, what harshness, what unbelief in each other can subsist in the presence of a great calamity, when all the artificial vesture of our life is gone, and we are all one with each other in primitive mortal needs? Vaguely Maggie felt this, in the strong resurgent love toward her brother, that swept away all the later impressions of hard, cruel offense and misunderstanding, and left only the deep, underlying, unshakable memories of early union. But now there was a large dark mass in the distance, and near to her Maggie could discern the current of the river. The dark mass must be, yes, it was St. Ogg's. Ah, now she knew which way to look for the first glimpse of the well-known trees, the gray willows, the now yellowing chestnuts, and above them the old roof. But there was no color, no shape yet. All was faint and dim. More and more strongly the energy seemed to come and put themselves forth, as if her life were a stored-up force that was being spent in this hour, unneeded for any future. She must get her boat into the current of the floss, else she would never be able to pass the ripple and approach the house. This was the thought that occurred to her, as she imagined with more and more vividness the state of things round the old home. But then she might be carried very far down, and be unable to guide her boat out of the current again. For the first time distinct ideas of danger began to press upon her, but there was no choice of courses, no room for hesitation, and she floated into the current. Swiftly she went now without effort, more and more clearly in the lessening distance, and the growing light she began to discern the objects that she knew must be the well-known trees and roofs. Nay, she was not far off a rushing, muddy current that must be the strangely altered ripple. Great God! There were floating masses in it that might dash against her boat as she passed, and cause her to perish too soon. What were those masses? For the first time Maggie's heart began to beat in an agony of dread. She sat helpless, dimly conscious that she was being floated along, more intensely conscious of the anticipated clash. But the horror was transient. It passed away before the oncoming warehouses of St. Ogg's. As he had passed the mouth of the ripple then, now, she must use all her skill and power to manage the boat and get it, if possible, out of the current. She could see now that the bridge was broken down. She could see the masts of a stranded vessel far out over the watery field. But no boats were to be seen moving on the river, such as had been laid hands on were employed in the flooded streets. With new resolution, Maggie seized her oar and stood up again to paddle, but the now ebbing tide added to the swiftness of the river, and she was carried along beyond the bridge. She could hear shouts from the windows overlooking the river, as if the people there were calling to her. It was not till as he had passed on nearly to Tofton that she could get the boat clear of the current. Then with one yearning look toward her Uncle Dean's house, that lay farther down the river, she took to both her oars, and rowed with all her might across the watery fields, back toward the mill. Color was beginning to awake now, and as she approached the Dorlcote fields, she could discern the tints of the trees, could see the old Scotch firs far to the right, and the home chestnuts. Oh, how deep they lay in the water, deeper than the trees on this side the hill. And the roof of the mill, where was it? Those heavy fragments hurrying down the ripple, what had they meant? But it was not the house. The house stood firm, drowned up to the first story, but still firm, or was it broken in at the end toward the mill? With panting joy that she was there at last, joy that overcame all distress, Maggie neared the front of the house. At first she heard no sound. She saw no object moving. Her boat was on a level with the upstairs window. She called out in a loud, piercing voice, "Tom, where are you? Mother, where are you? Here is Maggie." Soon, from the window of the attic in the central gable, she heard Tom's voice. "Who is it? Have you brought a boat?" "It is I, Tom, Maggie. Where is Mother?" "She is not here. She went to Garum the day before yesterday. I'll come down to the lower window." "Alone, Maggie?" said Tom, in a voice of deep astonishment, as he opened the middle window, on a level with the boat. "Yes, Tom. God has taken care of me to bring me to you. Get in quickly. Is there no one else? No, said Tom, stepping into the boat. I fear the man is drowned. He was carried down the ripple, I think, when part of the mill fell with the crash of trees and stones against it. I've shouted again and again, and there has been no answer. Give me the oars, Maggie. It was not till Tom had pushed off, and they were on the wide water, he face to face with Maggie, that the full meaning of what had happened rushed upon his mind. It came with so overpowering a force, it was such a new revelation to his spirit, of the depths in life, that had lain beyond his vision, which he had fancied so keen and clear, that he was unable to ask a question. They sat mutely gazing at each other, Maggie with eyes of intense life looking out from a weary, beaten face, Tom pale, with a certain awe and humiliation. Thought was busy, though the lips were silent, and though he could ask no question, he guessed a story of almost miraculous, divinely protected effort. But at last a mist gathered over the blue-gray eyes, and the lips found a word they could utter, the old childish Maxie. Maggie could make no answer but a long, deep sob of that mysterious, wondrous happiness that is one with pain. As soon as she could speak, she said, "We will go to Lucy, Tom. We'll go and see if she is safe, and then we can help the rest." Tom rowed with untired vigor, and with a different speed from poor Maggie's. The boat was soon in the current of the river again, and soon they would be at Tofton. "Park House stands high up out of the flood," said Maggie. "Perhaps they have got Lucy there." Nothing else was said. A new danger was being carried toward them by the river. Some wooden machinery had just given way on one of the wharves, and huge fragments were being floated along. The sun was rising now, and the wide area of watery desolation was spread out in dreadful clearness around them. In dreadful clearness floated onward the hurrying, threatening masses. A large company in a boat that was working its way along under the Tofton houses observed their danger, and shouted, "Get out of the current!" But that could not be done at once, and Tom, looking before him, saw death rushing on them. Huge fragments, clinging together in fatal fellowship, made one wide mass across the stream. "It is coming, Maggie," Tom said, in a deep, hoarse voice, loosing the oars, and clasping her. The next instant the boat was no longer seen upon the water, and the huge mass was hurrying on in hideous triumph. But soon the keel of the boat reappeared, a black speck on the golden water. The boat reappeared, but brother and sister had gone down in an embrace never to be parted, living through again in one supreme moment the days when they had clasped their little hands in love, and roamed the daisied fields together. Conclusion: nature repairs her ravages, repairs them with her sunshine, and with human labor. The desolation wrought by that flood had left little visible trace on the face of the earth, 5 years after. The fifth autumn was rich in golden corn stacks, rising in thick clusters among the distant hedgerows. The wharves and warehouses on the floss were busy again, with echoes of eager voices, with hopeful lading and unlading. And every man and woman mentioned in this history was still living, except those whose end we know. Nature repairs her ravages, but not all. The uptorn trees are not rooted again. The parted hills are left scarred. If there is a new growth, the trees are not the same as the old, and the hills underneath their green vesture bear the marks of the past rending. To the eyes that have dwelt on the past, there is no thorough repair. Dorlcote Mill was rebuilt, and Dorlcote Churchyard, where the brick grave that held a father whom we know, was found with the stone laid prostrate upon it after the flood had recovered all its grassy order and decent quiet. Near that brick grave there was a tomb erected, very soon after the flood, for two bodies that were found in close embrace, and it was visited at different moments by two men who both felt that their keenest joy and keenest sorrow were forever buried there. One of them visited the tomb again with a sweet face beside him, but that was years after. The other was always solitary. His great companionship was among the trees of the Red Deeps, where the buried joy seemed still to hover, like a revisiting spirit. the tomb bore the names of Tom and Maggie Tulliver, and below the names it was written, and their death they were not divided. End of the Project Gutenberg ebook of The Mill on the Floss, by George Eliot. End of the Project Gutenberg ebook The Mill on the Floss. This file should be named MLFLS10. TTXT or MLFLS10. Zip corrected editions of our ebooks get a new number, MLFLS11. TTXT versions based on separate sources get new letter, MLFLS10ATTXT, produced by Curtis Wayand and David Maddock. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as public domain in the US, unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we usually do not keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. We are now trying to release all our ebooks 1 year in advance of the official release dates, leaving time for better editing. Please be encouraged to tell us about any error or corrections, even years after the official publication date. Please note neither this listing nor its contents are final till midnight of the last day of the month of any such announcement. The official release date of all Project Gutenberg ebooks is at midnight, Central Time, of the last day of the stated month. A preliminary version may often be posted for suggestion, comment and editing by those who wish to do so. Most people started our websites at http://gutenberg.net or http://promo.net page. These websites include award-winning information about Project Gutenberg, including how to donate, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter free. Those of you who want to download any ebook before announcement can get to them as follows, and just download by date. This is also a good way to get them instantly upon announcement, as the indexes our catalogers produce obviously take a while after an announcement goes out in the Project Gutenberg newsletter. http://www.iabiblio.org Gutenberg ETEXT03 or FTP iabiblio.org PubDocs Books Gutenberg ETEXT03 or ETEXT02010099998997969594949392921 or 90. Just search by the first five letters of the file name you want, as it appears in our newsletters. Information about Project Gutenberg, one page. We produce about $2 million for each hour we work. The time it takes us, a rather conservative estimate, is 50 hours to get any ebook selected, entered, proofread, edited, copyright searched and analyzed, the copyright letters written, etc. Our projected audience is 100 million readers. If the value per text is nominally estimated at $1, then we produce $2 million per hour in 2002 as we release over 100 new text files per month. 1240 more ebooks in 2001 for a total of 4,000 plus we are already on our way to trying for 2,000 more ebooks in 2002. If they reach just 1-2% of the world's population then the total will reach over half a trillion ebooks given away by year's end. The goal of Project Gutenberg is to give away 1 trillion ebooks. This is 10,000 titles each to 100 million readers, which is only about 4% of the present number of computer users. Here is the briefest record of our progress. Means estimated, : ebooks year month, 1971 July 10 1991 January 100 1994 January 1000 1997 August 1500 1998 October 2000 1999 December 2500 2000 December 3000 2001 November 4000 2001 October November 6000 2002 December 9000 2003 November 10,000 2004 January. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation has been created to secure a future for Project Gutenberg into the next millennium. We need your donations more than ever. As of February 2002, contributions are being solicited from people and organizations in Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Connecticut, Delaware, District of Columbia, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. We have filed in all 50 states now, but these are the only ones that have responded. As the requirements for other states are met, additions to this list will be made, and fundraising will begin in the additional states. Please feel free to ask to check the status of your state. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.